Welcome, welcome, welcome to Jerry Roach's podcast. We're up to part two of chapter four, Touching History, Lucania, 1967. The trip was motivated, organized, and I was flying in to the peaks. Here we go. These glaciers ain't my home. It was like a supersized dream, and I could not absorb it all. As we flew up the Chitna River, I twitched with excitement as I caught tantalizing glimpses of the southern ramparts of Bona and University Peak through the swirling clouds. I resolved to return and climb those peaks some day. For a frozen moment, I saw the textbook moraines on the Barnard Glacier, where dark lines of rock rode on the glacier's surface, making it look like a striated ice monster. We flew over the snout of the Logan Glacier, then took a left up the Chitna Glacier. The Logan, Chitna, Anderson, and Walsh glaciers all come together near their snouts. The snow of the great peaks travels 50 miles from the summits to this convergence, and the peak's effluent was a wild, frenzied mess. On Denali, we wanted to walk out and couldn't. As I surveyed the shattered terrain below me, I knew that this time we had no intention of walking out, but what if we had to? We flew over the seldom-seen confluence of the Anderson and Chitna glaciers. The Anderson Glacier had surged the year before, and I couldn't believe that this scene was of Earth. When a glacier surges, it gets top-heavy and roars downhill at 10 or even 100 times its normal speed, trying to redistribute its load. In this case, the surface of the Anderson was an inverted chaos, a series of teetering pinnacles that held more air than ice. The bedlam extended completely across the Chitna, and I grimly noted that there was no way we could get past this obstacle on foot. We could not walk out this way. As the plane droned on, our commitment increased. Would Lucania reduce us to Washburn's forward retreat? Powerful passion seized me as we flew into the white open wilderness, or WOW, as I had learned to call it on Denali. It is one thing to look at pictures of great peaks and dream about climbing them. It is easy to pack food, buy gear, and talk about an imminent enterprise. It is effortless to exude confidence when you are sitting in the comfort of your living room. However, it is shocking and scary to come face to face with the reality of a great peak. The plane moves too fast, and you are never ready. I do not use the word great lightly. Unless you are brain-boring, the attributes of greatness will move you every time. As we approached Lucania, I strained for a view of the peak. But suddenly, no longer hidden, Lucania was now too big for my brain and too far above the tiny plane for my eyes. I was scared. Suddenly, we were there, and Wilson wanted to know where to go. My research paid off, and I felt as if I had already seen this topography, so I directed Wilson up the small tributary glacier leading under Lucania's west side. My hope was that we could find a place to land on the tributary and be in position to climb the west ridge. Our first views were not encouraging, since the spur glacier was narrow, steep, and full of crevasses. As we circled, I pointed to every piece of smooth snow over 100 yards long and hollered, "How about there?" Wilson continually shook his head hard and croaked, "No way!" He blanched whiter with each suggestion and finally turned the plane back toward the Chitna Glacier. Wilson was scared, too. The surface of the Chitna below us was bare ice, hence no good for a landing, so we flew up the glacier looking for snow. We soon passed the Fearn line, above which last winter's snow still covered the ice. I kept my mouth shut as Wilson flew a mile above the Fearn line, circled twice, and landed. Just before the plane stopped, the left ski went squish into slush. We both had a sinking feeling. The flight had drained both of us, and worse, the prospect of plunging into a crevasse terrified me. I crawled out on shaky legs, and my first few steps looked like a newborn chick's. The peak loomed thousands of feet above my dry mouth. Slowly, our equilibrium returned until we realized that we had to do something. We struggled with the plane, stomped a runway with our snowshoes, and struggled with the plane, but it was really stuck. After more effort, Wilson could just barely taxi the plane, but there was still no chance of taking off. We stomped a longer runway, positioned the plane at its top, and pitched camp. Wilson would have to spend the night here and hope for a freeze. This scene sounded astonishingly similar to Washburn's struggle 30 years earlier on the other side of the mountain. As late light curved across the huge face above us, I cooked a dinner that Wilson proclaimed commendable. Then we crawled into H-13, my old faded Himalayan tent from the Denali trip, and chatted through the long evening hours. As the weak sun finally slipped behind the last ridge, the temperature dropped and we dozed. Wilson popped awake at 4 a.m., pulled on his boots, crawled out of the tent, took a whiz, and headed straight for the plane. He opened the door, put one foot on the step, and turned back toward me. All he said was, "These glaciers ain't my home. I wouldn't land here again for $50,000. He pulled into the seat, slammed the door, fired the engine, and roared down the glacier. Never mind landing again, could he take off? The plane struggled down the glacier and past the end of our runway, but Wilson kept going until the fading engine drone echoed off the mountain walls. The plane disappeared from my sight where the glacier dipped at a steeper angle, but I knew that Wilson was rapidly approaching a series of crevasses and bare ice below the Fearn line. He was going for it on this run, and he would either lift off in time or be beyond trouble. A thousand thoughts raced through my mind. Then the sound of the engine faded, and I thought, "Oh no, he's crashed!" Several seconds later, I heard a much fainter sound, then barely saw the plane. Finally airborne, it was already a small speck in the sky, and it rapidly disappeared down the valley. Soon the faint sound ebbed into silence. Wilson was gone. I stood still for a long moment, then slowly turned in a circle. No climber had ever seen this view, especially a solo climber. I was in frosty shadows at 7,000 feet, but Lucania's summit, 10,000 feet above me, basked in the morning sun, and purifying purple light crept toward me. I did another slow 360-degree turn and scanned the exquisite basin carefully. In the silence, I was acutely aware that I was alone. There was something sinister in Wilson's voice when he said that he wouldn't land here again. Did he mean that he wouldn't come back at all? Rationality said surely not, but turbid thoughts tugged at the corners of my mind. I went straight to the tangled heap of food and equipment that still lay where we had pitched it out of the plane. As I carefully sorted and stacked it near the tent, I was relieved to discover enough food and fuel to last me 80 days. I was not dead yet, but dismayed, I also saw that I had 2 pairs of snowshoes with me. The likely resolution was for Wilson to land the others farther up the glacier, where the snow was better, then they would have to descend on their snowshoes to rescue me. I had been a little too nonchalant back at May Creek and was still learning from the great peaks. I studied the terrain in great detail and thought about what things could kill me. Walking around on the glacier solo and falling into a crevasse was at the top of my list. Another huge hazard was that a big avalanche could roar down Lucania's north face and bury my tiny camp, so I studied the face carefully. Trapped between 2 treasons, it was a gamble either way. There was no place on the glacier that I was willing to walk to that looked significantly better, so I decided to stay where I was. I hoped that no huge storms would load the face above me with snow and increase the avalanche hazard to some ridiculous level. Then there was illness and a host of other unlikely problems that I just wasn't going to worry about. I hunkered down and meditated on the tone in Wilson's voice. As I prepared my precarious position, the clouds lowered, then unleashed fat flakes that drove me into my tent. I could no longer see the face above me, so its danger became an unseen unknown. Did I have to re-choose between avalanche and crevasse? I listened to syncopated snowflakes hitting H-13 for an hour, then drifted into an uneasy sleep. Coughing and sputtering, I yanked the sleeping bag hood away from my face, lurched up, and banged my head on the tent pole. Ouch! At least this pain was minor and real. My dream about falling into a crevasse had been too real. Panting, I quickly opened the tent door, peered into the northern night, and inhaled deeply. Clouds still held the mountain, but I saw a strange light. It purged the nightmare, and I knew that my decision to remain in this camp was the correct one. I decided to stay within 30 feet of the tent. The next day, heavy snowfall continued, and I continued to worry about avalanches and crevasses. Nevertheless, I held my position. When the snow turned to rain, I wondered if Washburn's deliverance from this place was a paradigm for our trip. I realized that there was nothing I could do about avalanches, so fell into a reverie. In the evening, the clouds lifted, light rays filtered through to the glacier, and I felt in communion with the Grand Peaks. I liked it here. My time alone on the virgin Chitna Glacier has remained rustic in my memory. Sometimes I learn by stopping, looking, listening, and thinking. I bathed in my personal paradigm lost. On June 22nd, it cleared and Wilson flew over. He was high. He wagged his wings, then continued up the glacier, way up. He disappeared, and I assumed that he was bringing the rest of the team into the upper basin at the head of the Chitna. He made two more flights, finally dropping me a note explaining that the others were indeed safely at 9,000 feet, that they would come down to rescue me. Then he disappeared, and I was alone again. Now we would test the extent of my error in bringing the extra snowshoes in with me. Halpern, Gary, and Mike had to struggle down 9 miles of unknown glacier with only two pairs of snowshoes. The next day I was relieved to see three specks slowly advancing down the glacier. But when I looked again, there were only two specks. Uh-oh! Someone had fallen into a crevasse. They were still 2 miles away, and I was unable to help. So I watched in agony for several long minutes until the third speck reappeared. When they pulled into camp, they confirmed that Gary had indeed fallen into a crevasse. This was the first of several crevasse falls that awaited us. It had been 5 days since I had left May Creek, and we were glad to be reunited. The expedition supplies were at two different locations, 9 miles apart, and this was a problem. But I remembered Washburn's trip and was glad that all four of us were on the glacier. At least we could get on with the job of climbing the mountain. My time of meditation and communion was over, and a period of hard work lay ahead. Wandhenge. Our route decision was made for us since the bottom of the North Ridge was between our two landing sites, while the start of the West Ridge route was 8 difficult miles beyond the lower landing site. We would climb the North Ridge. For the next several days, we slaved to consolidate our supplies under the North Ridge. Halpern joked that the badly crevassed Chitna Glacier was the pits. It was a maze of crisscrossed crevasses that formed between a pressure ridge on the glacier and the base of the mountain. Snow fell every day, but we wandered the route during the evening clearings, then moved the loads during the daily whiteouts. We relied heavily on our wands, and I developed Roach's rules of wanding. On straight stretches, we placed wands on the left side of the trail going toward the summit. This mimicked Sailing's red right return rule, since our wands were red. The analogy was perfect. The heck with Sailing, the real reason for this rule was that I could place the wands with my left hand, leaving my right hand free for more important things, like holding my ice axe. In crevassed areas, we placed wands so that we walked straight from one to the next. We placed corner wands on the outside of the turn, so that the rope didn't knock the wand over as we marched by. This meant that we violated the red right return rule half the time on corners. But two adjacent wands solved this problem. Leaving nothing to guesswork, we marked crevasses with two crossed wands, which was our crude skull and crossbones. Well, it was just the crossbones, but we got the message. We crept over to the base of the north ridge, carefully probed the best area that we could find, and pitched a precarious base camp at 8,500 feet. We put wands in a circle around the probed area, then deciding to name our camps, not just number them, Halpern authored the petite epigram, Wandhenge, for our haven. It took another day to get everything into Wandhenge, and we dropped our last load with a loud wee honkin'. Now all we had to do was climb the mountain. On the first excursion beyond Wandhenge, I discovered a small crevasse a few feet beyond the camp's perimeter. I enlarged the hole to make it more visible, applied Roach's rules, and marked the crevasse with crossed wands on the left side of the trail. After crossing several more bad crevasses, we reached the ridge at 10,000 feet and found a small bench where we could camp. The ridge above looked beautiful. We decided to rapidly shuttle all our loads to the bench, move camp, and climb the upper part of the ridge from the bench. The crevasses spooked us, and we wanted to be done with them. Working in nature's minefield, we even named the crevasses. The one near Wandhenge was Henge Hole. We named another one the Hairy Step. Day by day, the crevasses yawned wider. That night, 18 inches of new snow covered Henge Hole. The next morning, after preparing big loads, I put my pack on and stood by the tent fastening my waist belt as Mike started out of Wandhenge. Suddenly, the rope hissed across the snow, and the next second I did three things. I realized Mike was falling. That took most of the time. Then I simultaneously fell down and grabbed my ice axe, which was stuck in the snow next to the tent. I was just barely quick enough. The rope jerked tight as I hit the snow. My weight plus the weight of my pack made a good anchor, but Mike had vanished. There was only a hole in the snow where he had been. Mike had walked on the wrong side of my crossed wands and plunged straight into Henge Hole. Since we were still in camp, we had not yet stretched the rope tight between us, and the amount of slack rope became the length of his fall. Gary gave Halpern a belay, and within seconds, Halpern peered into Henge Hole. I heard Halpern talking to Mike, but could not hear Mike. I hollered, "Where is he? Where is he?" Halpern intoned calmly, "He's down." Was my crevasse dream coming true? Halpern talked to Mike and learned that he was not seriously injured, but that he was 40 feet down in the narrow, twisting chasm. After hollering back and forth, we lowered Mike 3 feet to a snow shelf where he was able to take off his pack. Then we lowered him a second rope and tried to pull up his pack. As we pulled, the pack scraped against the uneven sides of the crevasse, sending serious showers of ice down on Mike. This tactic was no good. Finally, Mike announced that he would keep his pack on and try to jumar out of the crevasse. Before the trip, we had a big debate about whether to buy the then newfangled expensive camming devices called jumars. They slid easily up the rope, but held with a downward pull. With slings from the jumars to each foot, we could ascend a fixed vertical rope by moving up 1 foot while standing on the other. We could have done the same procedure with rope gripping prussic knots, but jumars were much easier to use. Pooling our money, we had bought one pair of jumars for the team. Our now vital jumars were in the side pocket of my pack, so we quickly retrieved them and lowered them to Mike. We praised our providential purchase as Mike slowly struggled up past the nasty gargoyles that festooned Henge Hole, while we belayed him from above with the second rope. An hour after Mike plunged into Henge Hole, he crawled back out. We shuffled a few feet over to the tent, rolled in, and called it a day. Gary gave Mike a complete medical check, and we welcomed his expertise. It appeared that Mike only had bruises from ricocheting off the gargoyles during his fall. We were still at the bottom of the mountain, and I wondered what waited for us higher. We added even more precautions with the crevasses, including belaying each other in and out of camp. We were alone up here, and being smart was just as important as being strong. The next day, we worked like drivers released from a traffic jam, carried all our loads to the bench, and pitched tow camp at 10,000 feet. We were delighted to leave Wandenge. Ding Ridge. Tow camp's exposed position excited us, since we felt less confined now that we were above the glacier. Above us was 3,500 feet of ridge, the crux of our route. We spent the next day preparing the narrow section of ridge above tow camp, then cached 8 loads on the rounded upper ridge. On July 1, we plowed a deep trough up our ridge to the edge of the long-sought, still-elusive plateau. As we made the first descent of Lucania's North Ridge, we irreverently named it Ding Ridge. The weather was usually marginal but never horrible. That night, back in tow camp, it became horrible. I had never seen snow fall so hard for so long. It fell at 2 inches per hour through the next day. We shoveled around the tents all day, then went to sleep for another snowbound night. I woke to a rifle shot and didn't know what had happened until I tried to sit up and my face smacked into wet nylon. The tent pole had broken. I thrashed around, then crawled out into a white world. There was so much snow that I couldn't see the tent. Several feet of Lucania powder had fallen on the tent until the center pole collapsed with a sickening snap. As I wallowed around camp, I chuckled at the thought of selling this powder to Colorado ski areas. If I could transport it just like this, I would get rich. I roused the others, and feeling like archaeologists looking for our own city, we slowly shoveled the skier's delight away from tow camp. The skies cleared while we shoveled. The last twinkling snow in the air dissipated, and we worked transfixed as a fairyland appeared around us. Usually we saw the views in small pieces through the clouds, but today the Chitna Basin sparkled in all its glittering glory. The avalanche danger was extreme, so we spent the clearest day of the trip in tow camp. From this safe haven, we watched huge avalanches race down Lucania's north face and roar across the Chitna Glacier. One of them covered our old tracks near the lower landing site. It remained unspoken, but it was obvious that my original concern on the glacier had been a good one. Since we had no choice, we repaired the tent pole. Late in the day, Wilson flew over on one of our prearranged check flights, but he was too high, so did not see us in the wow. At first, the sight and sound of the small plane was reassuring, but then horrendous emotions ravaged me, stretching and tearing me between the peak and the outside world. I felt lonely, sad, impatient, and tired. The plane was an interruption. It broke our rhythm. When no one was looking, I smudged a tear from the corner of my right eye. After Wilson left, I felt our isolation even more acutely. We were indeed in the middle of nowhere and everywhere on Lucania. On July 4, I thought about my summit day on Denali 4 years earlier, then celebrated my anniversary by replowing a deep trough through the new snow as we made the second ascent of Ding Ridge. We reached the edge of the Lucania Steel Plateau after many hours of labor, but I did not feel heroic. It was just hard work. Steel Summit was 4 miles to the east, and Lucania Summit was 5 miles southwest. Our efforts had indeed delivered us into a new dimension, and suddenly the summits looked attainable. I wee-honkened to the gods, then chowed down on figs and cheese. Stay tuned for the conclusion of this exciting climb up Mount Lucania in 1967.